Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Keep your mic, actually stand that way. Now turn around. So the microphone's not pointing.
Okay.
All right.
Okay,
great.
We popped into the auditorium, and there was a man in a full-body Bender from Futurama costume. We don't know why, and perhaps don't want to know why, because, you know, there is no possible reason for it that would be more satisfying than the mystery.
Wait, you saw that?
Yeah.
Here? Today?
Yeah, just in there.
Wow. So we're here in the Isabel Bader Theater on the U of T campus, mm-hmm. about to watch the sixth and final Ontario Liberal leadership debate. The Ontario Liberals are poised to select who is going to replace Kathleen Wynne and battle it out against Doug Ford in the provincial election in 2 years. I'm Allison Smith, publisher of Queen's Park Today.
I'm Jonathan Goldsby, news editor at Canadaland.
You're listening to Wag the Doug, popping up at the Isabel Bader Theatre in downtown Toronto for the Ontario Liberal leadership debate.
I have seen Chris Rock, Werner Herzog, and Eddie Vedder on this stage, and the Liberal leadership candidates were not any of them.
After our coverage of this endlessly exciting, nonstop, rock'em sock'em Ontario Liberal leadership debate, Jonathan and I are going to give our review, our thoughts on
Run This Town, that Damian Lewis in a fat suit as Rob Ford movie, which comes out next week.
And off to the debate.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The fact is that Stephen Del Duca already has the overwhelming majority of delegates, committed delegates in the race. So barring his death, barring a sudden death, he is going to be the next Liberal leader. This is some sort of needless performance so that they don't lose their deposit on the theater, apparently. So that is why we're here, because I love this idea of a debate that requires no audience. Roger Ebert once said about the movie I Heart Huckabees, it was the first movie that didn't require an audience between the projector and the screen. And so we're here to see what that looks like, what the political equivalent of that is.
Especially because this debate was at the beginning of the race sort of touted as the pinnacle debate, right? This was supposed to be the centerpiece of the campaign where everyone's truly battling it out. Of course, they staged all of their delegate votes ahead of time, and now there's absolutely no stakes tonight whatsoever.
Yeah. I really don't know what to expect.
There is one way, not barring Del Duca's death, that he could possibly lose. So all of the 1,200 or so delegates that he has assigned to him, when they go to the convention, which is on March 7th, they're going to get pre-written out forms, voting slips that have his name on it already. But apparently there's about a five-second walk between where they're handed the ballot and where they submit it. So if a good two-thirds of them decide to eat their ballot along the way, then we could really have a race.
Two-thirds, like, would it be like, what, 600 of them or something?
Sure, we could go with that. I'm not looking at the numbers right now.
600 people swallow their paper ballot, but they would still didn't have another.
Well, then they could vote on the second ballot, right? Then the second ballot is when it would open it up. If Del Duca loses on the first ballot because everyone eats theirs, then they would have a second ballot, and then the race could really get going.
Let's head in and see what other Futurama characters we see.
This is going to be an exciting and thought-provoking evening. Tonight, you'll get a chance to hear each of our provincial Liberal candidates give their views on the topics that are important to Ontario residents.
Doug Ford told this entire province that he very clearly does not view Andrea Horvath and the Ontario NDP as the threat to him or his party winning a second majority government. He spent all of his time, while epic numbers of protesters were standing outside in Niagara Region, telling the whole world that he's afraid of us.
I believe that housing is a human right, and it's not a privilege.
We need to do a better job of working with, listening to, and supporting municipalities in solutions that make sense in their communities.
We need to look at brownfield sites that are here in the province and mitigate the liability that a developer can put on by working with government to ensure that there's more opportunity.
I'm really happy to know that the federal government, from what I understand, is reviewing the mortgage stress test.
I've got a few more ideas I'll maybe talk about if I'm given another opportunity. And I have lots of ideas that I can talk about in the supplemental.
So as Brenda said, I think Kate said it as well, pretty much everyone on the stage is going to agree that we need more transit, which is a really fantastic thing.
The difference between the other men on this stage is that I have hair and I have three kids instead of two. But...
And so I've proposed a tax on Airbnb so that we can...
I am going to have to stop you there. I apologize, but we are out of time.
So if you were coming looking for a hard-hitting debate and the Elizabeth Warren-Michael Bloomberg moment, I think you're leaving pretty disappointed tonight.
Are we recording now?
Yes.
I've been holding that in so we can get that on tape. Oh my god.
120 minutes.
Wow. It's like there's like that episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine where Miles O'Brien is captured by some aliens and he's tortured by, like, they make him feel like 1,000 years have passed in this prison, but it's all in his mind and really only been a few days.
Yeah, I think it's been longer.
Yeah.
I think it goes to show that grassroots democracy is very boring.
The thing is, I don't think it has to be, and I don't think it is. I think what the real triumph here is that they somehow took an inherently interesting subjects and made them boring. That's the thing. Is like politics is, I mean, there's undoubtedly an overemphasis on the theatrics, on the performance, on the presentation. I mean, it is at core of a policy and ideas. But you have to be able to
like step
engage
one
people.
Inch outside of the box of the most basic proposal you could possibly imagine. Like, let's build more affordable housing, for example. They had a very long conversation about housing, but it went nowhere interesting or innovative or even, I mean, beyond something that they could have had the same conversation 14 years ago.
But even when they did, like you know, Michael Coteau proposing, you know, fair free transit. That's an exciting policy. How can you make an exciting policy sound boring?
Well, we build a transit system that has the most reduced possible barriers. So you can walk in and walk out without any barriers, paying for parking, paying for transit. Now, it's very aspirational and it will be a 10-year approach.
If you can't articulate ideas, you know, valid, interesting, daring, bold, policies that would help people's lives. If you can't articulate those in a way that would actually reach the people whose lives they would help, let alone, like, if you can't even get into us, let alone the actual people who aren't engaged, at best it's academic, but that's mean to academics, frankly. Some of them are very engaging.
Did you note the weird transportation portion where they started talking about the possibility of automated vehicles? Somehow Del Duca pivoted that to talk about how the former Liberal government started letting people pilot or firm's pilot automated vehicles on Ontario roads, which is factually accurate. They did. And then somehow being like, and because we're about progress.
The enabling regulatory legislation, was that the term you used?
First of all, I think as Liberals, we need to remember and be proud of the fact that it was our last Liberal government that actually introduced the enabling regulatory changes to permit the testing of automated vehicles.
The one part time they actually seemed, or at least four of them seemed to wake up, was actually discussing, and what could broadly be termed identity politics, but we're discussing basically hate and bigotry in Ontario as manifested by the current government. Alvin Tejo stating in no uncertain terms, Doug Ford is a bigot, and then daring anyone to prove him wrong.
The problem we have right now is that we have a bigot in the Premier's office. And I mean that. Prove me wrong.
Mitzi Hunter describing, you know, Doug Ford as the most anti-women premier ever.
Being one of the most anti-woman premier ever.
Which is a bit of an overstatement, but they seem to wake up, and it woke the audience up when they started to actually speak with passion and a simple and in fairly clear, direct terms. Because frankly, it's amazing that so much of this debate is about, you know, these are people who want to topple Doug Ford. It's really amazing that any given six people could have that as their goal and not be compelling or exciting or interesting about that. And so when they finally got to this handful of subjects, it felt like they found a sense of purpose, mission, passion, for sure.
Mitzi Hunter has said that before. She's kind of used it as, I would say, a push for some media attention 3 or 4 weeks ago, nearing the delegate portion of the leadership campaign. And she makes good points. She didn't really get into them tonight, but and this is stuff we haven't talked about on the podcast before, but it's worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. The Doug Ford government reduced funding for the Association of Ontario Midwives. They basically failed to enact a Liberal government gender discrimination pay law. They've reduced funding for rape crisis centers. So there are things like that that, I mean, she's right about, and that is an interesting angle to go on. Of course, she's done terribly in this race, unfortunately for her. But you're right that people did sort of jump to attention a little bit at that moment. But then it got so technocratic and weird, like the whole thing. Brenda Hollingsworth's proposal for...
She's a person in the race, by the way.
She's a person in the race. Proposal for fighting systemic racism in Canada, in Ontario, was to change procurement laws so that you couldn't sell goods to the government unless you had a diversity plan within your company.
I mean, it's not the worst idea. It's a decent policy. I'm not sure it's like the top five things you could do to end systemic racism, but it's okay.
I know. It's not terrible, but it's just like, again, and she really didn't sell it. We can add that to the list. I mean, the problem with this, like, overall race and, you know, what will possibly very much hurt the Liberal Party when it comes to them trying to defeat Doug Ford is that nobody interesting entered this race, right? That's sort of what we're, like, they had no star candidate. People had hoped that after the federal election last fall, maybe some Ottawa... some folks, Liberals from Ottawa, might come over here and jump in. And of course, that didn't happen. So it's just, it never really even got off the ground. And I don't know if that's because, you know, going up against Doug Ford as a politician might not be appealing to lots of people, or whether there's just like a little bit of a lack of interest in high profile or successful people just, you know, entering the political fray when the stakes are not as exciting as, you know, winning the Democratic primary in the United States.
I don't know if it's necessarily a lack of interesting candidates, though it's not the greatest crop, but like it is a party that encourages ambition, but possibly only ambition. I may have mentioned this before, but unlike the NDP or the PCs, which, you know, people tend to be bound by ideology. I mean, that's – I don't mean that as a bad thing. I'm saying people are bound together. Like, that's what the raison d'etre of a party is. You have a very particular vision of what you think would be best for people, what you think would be best for society, and you want to take steps toward enacting that. Liberals have always – you know, as the centrist party, have always been a curious thing where it feels like the most – their defining factor or the most common trait isn't an ideology, but rather a personality type, a particular...
Like the person who would tell on you in elementary school.
No, more like the person who would run for class president because
they would
be good at it, not because of what they want to do. Kind of what... I mean, that's the thing is the liberals when they...
It's
when,
like the goody two-shoes party.
I feel like that's giving them too much credit. I think it's when the liberals... are almost nothing but whoever is a leader at a given time. When the liberals have no leader, there's no glue holding them together. They could be whatever they want to be, and frankly, they don't really stand for much. I mean, they want to make things better, but, you know, not too much better. It's like good enough. You know, it takes a very particular type of leader to actually take the message status quo and make it status quo, but a little bit better and make it inspiring.
Actually, one thing I do want to say. In all of this talk, so they kept talking about how great it is that they were unlike the PC party leadership that happened when Doug Ford was elected the leader. And there was a lot of battle and combativeness between the different leadership candidates, which included Caroline Mulroney and Christine Elliott. And that this time they're not like that. We work together so hard and our staff does too. I will say, us reporting at Queen's Park, there was a plenty of different. You can't even single out one camp because they were all doing it. But the staff from the various leadership parties trying to throw other candidates under the bus with different tactics and whispering in reporters' ears went on a lot for all this unity talk.
Oh, what's your favorite? Without naming names.
Oh, it was all so boring. I hated it.
Oh, God. Even their back channel dirt on each other was boring?
It was so annoying. Yeah,
no.
Oh,
my God.
I don't know. So Del Duca moved. The Ontario Liberal Party had to downgrade to a smaller office headquarters after the last election when they lost all their seats and their money. And his campaign moved into the same office building, a different floor of it. And then there was controversy over whether this meant that they were working too closely with the party and whether they were allowed to talk in the hallways or not. And other campaigns were trying to, you know, make this into a scandal. But
oh my God.
Of course, nobody cared.
It's like, you know, he's done actual like shit things in government. And yet that's what they sort of... Oh, my God.
So I guess the question, you know, well, what they did AMP a bunch of times during the race is to come to our leadership convention on March 7th or March 6th and 7th. I think they just want lots of members to go because they have to pay. And this party is very broke. so that, I think, was the reason for that heavy push. But should liberals in Ontario be slightly jazzed by a Del Duca win? And if you were to make the argument that this is a good thing for the party, I think the way you would make it is that how much Del Duca truly did kick everyone's butt in the raising of delegates. So he got, I was looking at the numbers, like 1,100 out of 2,000. So 54%.
In a six-way race.
In a six-way race. So he won by a landslide. What that means in practical terms for political people is that he has a good organization campaign. So what that means is if anyone's going to go up against Doug Ford organizationally, this guy does by far have the best chance. And I think that might make liberals happy.
I guess, I mean, you could imagine Doug Ford just like flicking him away, just talking over him or flicking him away on a stage. Doug Ford is massively unpopular, but he has charisma, which is like almost a gross thing to say. But I mean, frankly, the fact that so few Canadian politicians have that takes you kind of far. But of course, talking about the horse race, I guess we're talking, not talking about Andrea Horvath, but once again, I've yet to have any specific reason to believe she would do any better in an election campaign than she has done in her last three.
I mean, I think what you speak to, we want to talk about the specifics of why Del Duca is a flawed, I think, rival to or flawed leader of a party is, yeah, that he is very much caught up in the Kathleen Wynne scandals and the old Liberal Party. He was a minister under them. He did some dodgy stuff. And that's exactly what the people of Ontario voted the Liberal Party down to 7 seats for. And he is like an embodiment of that. And mm-hmm. that makes him easy, as you said, for Doug Ford to, you know, flick him off a stage.
What should I know about you?
You're a writer.
Pitch me.
Dare I ask where you last worked?
I worked in the mayor's office.
Dave, I've been working for more than a year now. I think that I could be really useful with this sort of thing.
You know you don't get to be editor on day two just because you showed up on day one.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
You called, but said you wanted to meet in person about your story.
We're not taking the story unless we can see the video.
Can you imagine the uproar?
Hey, sorry, do you work here?
I'm just an assistant.
So how does this video come your way?
What am I looking at?
So Jonathan and I are back in the studio to tell you about the newest piece in the Ford mythology, the Hollywood film Run This Town.
It's a very, very generous use of the word Hollywood. It's a Canadian film. It's nominated for 3 Canadian Screen Awards, which actually happens to be the same number of Canadian Screen Awards that last year's Canadian Screen Awards are nominated for at this year's Canadian Screen Awards.
Has at least one Hollywood star in it, that being Damian Lewis, who plays Rob Ford in a fat
yes.
suit.
Ostensibly, he's in there.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have chosen anyone.
So the film tells the story of the Rob Ford crack tape scandal.
It tells a story of the Rob Ford crack tape scandal.
That's more apt. And sort of from the point of view of a journalist who is breaking the story. Kind of. Actually, he just keeps getting scooped by other newspapers, which is very vague. Who keeps beating him to it and how? Of course, one of the major problems right off the bat with this, which has been much pointed out in early conversations about the film, is that they chose a young male to play the role of the journalist that broke the story or saw the crack tape, as opposed to a female like Robin Doolittle.
There is a problem there, but it's not so much that they replaced Robin Doolittle with a man, because emphatically the point is that this is a guy who is starting out and is not especially good or competent at the job at all. I think the question is not so much why did they put him at the center of the crack story, as why did the director implicitly believe that this man's story, this story of an incompetent, privileged male journalist, writer-director believe that's more relatable than the story of a competent female journalist. I mean, the shortest, easiest answer is because, I mean, someone else optioned Robin's book. That doesn't excuse it at all. It's still a fucking problem, and it pervades the whole movie. But there is that weird thing that there was an option for Crazy Town, which was Robin Doolittle's book. The studio had that, or maybe still has it. There were scripts written, never got produced, almost certainly never will be produced.
So basically he's told a worse, dumber story and made a bad film out of a fascinating, riveting tale that, entranced the whole world at one point in time and turned it into kind of a weird like manifesto on millennial malaise. It was kind of a lot of this guy just moping around and complaining about his job. And
it's 100% as promised. There was an interview, a damage control interview the director did with The Globe a couple years ago after the whole Ben Platt casting thing came out, in which the Globe wrote...
Ben Platt plays the journalist.
Bram Shriver. The Globe, I think it was Simon Haupt, wrote, Run This Town is loosely based on Tolman's brother Jason, who worked as an overnight anchor and reporter at 680 News and as a newswriter at City TV before leaving journalism entirely. Then the quote, it's about a guy who dreams of being an investigative journalist, doesn't know how to, so wishes that they were a part of something that they're not. I think that's a potentially interesting premise.
But that's not what happens in the movie, really.
I think he thinks that's what happens in the movie. I think he thinks that's what it is. And I do think there are potentially many good ways to tell the Rob Ford story that aren't just like a straight ahead retelling of Crazy Town or a straight ahead retelling of what happened. And I
think, sure, you could tell it like from his family's point of view. That might be interesting.
So many ways that it could be told. I don't think it's bad. I think it's too interesting and ambitious to be bad, in the same way that like mid to late period Spike Lee films are often too, like, there's really interesting messes. And I'm talking about now about things like you probably no one's even heard of, like She Hate Me and Miracle at St. Anna. Really minor shit. But one of the big issues is that the whole thing seems anachronistic in its mode of storytelling and rather dated. I mean,
confusing. Like, for someone who knows this story very well, it was hard to follow the plot, I thought, at times. Like, time periods kind of jumped apart. The opening sequence with the staff made no sense. They had all of these people sitting around Toronto City Hall in the counselor's seats, these young people. And it turns out, you figure out later, that they're all staffers to Rob Ford or various jobs in the mayor's office or in City Hall.
It's very unclear. Yeah, that the scene makes no sense.
And they're kind of debating office expenses as if they're counselors, but
they're not.
They're not. And
if you don't know that they're, like, if you don't recognize, like, hey, that's not Counselor Mahaffey, you know, how many people know whoever's, I mean, how many people will ever see this movie
beer,
in the first place?
So you have an idea that they're not, like, that they're just goofing off, but to what end? And then they weirdly kind of throw back to that when they're talking about office expenses later. I don't know. It was weird.
It's like, I can't hate a movie that tries to make a dramatic, intense title sequence with lots of split screens and lots of flashy words out of a totally unremarkable and inconsequential and wholly forgotten Counselor Fletcher speech about office expenses from God knows what year.
I thought that was so bizarre.
It makes no sense. It will mean nothing to anyone. It doesn't even mean anything to me.
There's so much crazy Rob Ford footage, or related to Rob Ford footage, that happened in the City Hall chambers, and this is just not it. You can't even really tell what they're talking about.
No. I mean, I've so much. So, I mean, Damian Lewis as Rob, that's the other thing, is in every respect, that is exactly what you would imagine. I mean, the movie is the well-meaning but fundamentally misguided horror show that the Rob Ford story deserves. He doesn't try to do an impression of Rob Ford. And
no, he just speaks in like a Canadian kind of hoser accent was not good.
It's like whatever. I mean, in early reviews compared it to Fat Bastard, which I think, frankly, Rob Ford was more like a Mike Myers character than he's played here.
Well, his eyes are too sunken into his face. That's the weirdest part.
It doesn't have to look like Rob Ford. Frankly, if you try to recreate Rob Ford exactly, it wouldn't work. But it doesn't look like a real human.
No, yeah.
And that's where, in a movie that is otherwise trying to be grounded, it plays like a whole other thing inserting itself into that movie. And I don't think the metaphor of this cartoonish figure walking into this real world is intentional.
No.
To the extent this movie will be remembered in the future at all, I assume it will be this sort of an infamous freak show where screen caps of Damian Lewis as Rob Ford will show up in shitpost memes the same way that Dana Carvey as the Turtle Man and Master of Disguise does now.
If I haven't made this clear yet, I did not like this movie. I have all the time in the world for like white collar crime mystery movies or journalist movies or movies that have like a slow build to like find out a secret. Honestly, one of my favorite genres. This tried to be that, wasn't that. And like, honestly, if I was watching this at home, I probably would have turned it off halfway through. Like, I was very bored.
I mean, no one will ever see it in a theater, so you don't have to. Okay, maybe that's too mean. Yeah, I had the very odd experience watching this movie of realizing that I think the main character is partly based on me.
Well, yeah, that's true.
That was very odd. I meant to start with this because I guess it does color my feelings about it. But at one point, he describes, for whatever reason, he's a guy who writes best of lists for a newspaper. That job doesn't actually
exist.
Which
they nonstop talk about. How many times is the word listicle used in that film? Probably 25.
But at a certain point, after a certain amount of time in the job, he tells his friend that he's got new responsibilities, which include reverse engineering Rob Ford's schedule by going through posts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And I was racking my brain, like, has anyone else ever described that work or been described as doing that in those words or at all? Pretty sure I'm the only person who did that in any systematic fashion and used those exact words in a number of different contexts.
If you were being interviewed or describing yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I first wondered, like, fuck, is that what Robin wrote in her book? And I checked and it wasn't. But no, I used it in an Now article, and it's in my Facebook profile, LinkedIn, but I wouldn't expect you to see it there.
No, that was you. I thought of you immediately, and I guess that would be one of the very specific parts of the film.
Yeah.
I would say. I'll give it, okay, the part that I actually thought was the most successful was the sexual harassment, how that part is told when the Rob Ford character sexually harasses the female staffer, and she later has a conversation. And that scene's well done. So Nina Dobrev actually plays that character, and she's, again, a Hollywood actress and is good at acting. So I
but
think that's
Canadian
probably,
enough that they would get the points toward the tax credits, right?
I don't know.
Sorry, okay.
But she's a good actress, so I think that's probably why this part stands out. And, you know, how humiliated she is because it happens in front of a bunch of people, and then how she's disappointed in her boyfriend because he never doesn't stand up for her, doesn't tell Rob Ford to apologize, and she kind of says, you know, you just made me another woman or another incident that we had to bury, and she's upset with him for that. And I thought that part was well done. Back to the Millennial Manifesto part. Like, I was just trying to see, like, what can you, like, extrapolate from the Rob Ford story that would shine any sort of light on this millennial, you know, struggling millennial or struggling privileged millennial story that he's trying to tell. And I feel like they have, like, a teeny glimmer of insight kind of at the very end when he mentions, basically, like, politicians are kind of screwing the next generation. It's like in the middle of a speech, and it kind of alludes to that. And I don't know if the director wanted to make a tie between politics in the last 30 years and maybe even the more recent history, how politicians have, you know, that can suck. And, like, that's why things are bad, but I don't know if that's even too much of a stretch.
I did wonder if he at any point he or anyone involved in the movie had reached out to Olivia Gondek, who's basically the character who's fictionalizes the Nina Dobrev character. I don't know, without assuming one way or the other, I could imagine that at worst it could effectively re-victimize her in a way that, you know, it, in trying to tell a story from her perspective actually maybe doesn't help. But I don't know. Maybe it's done with her full knowledge and consent, and maybe that's exactly how she would like the story told. I don't know, but I guess just because the movie skates around, the way it's hues so close to real life in some respects and diverges in others, which is fine. That's pretty much what, once again, pretty much what all art does. But you do find, or at least, you know, Torontonians, and I don't know who else will ever see this movie, you do find yourself thinking and reflecting on those gaps in those spaces and the choices that were made in terms of which things to reflect faithfully and accurately and which things to fictionalize.
Well, right. Why recreate that I'm more than enough to eat at home press conference and scene? I guess it is because they want to talk about the sexual or alleged sexual harassment in the office, but then...
Oh, he's dead. We don't have to say alleged anymore.
Okay, well, we watch... but there's a few scenes of the journalist watching the actual crack tape, and they don't recreate that.
That would have been such a great gif for later, because you can't gif the actual crack tape. That'd be awful. But if we had Damian Lewis recreating the crack tape, and I was really hoping we would, that would be such a wonderful thing to gif.
Well, and you just sort of get to see, like, the back of the phone and his eyes light up as he watches it.
Like, cinematically, that's more effective, but it just would have been entertaining to see it recreated.
I was wishing it was, like, a better actor behind those eyes that was giving me something. It was mostly just him looking.
Oh, that's why it would have been so entertaining, right? The idea of them trying to restage it would have just, oh my God, it would have been sublime.
I mean, I like your take that this not-so-great movie... that's just kind of messy and all over the place and doesn't really achieve much is a good, what did you say, semblance of just the Rob Ford saga deserves.
Yeah, the story deserves. It's weird and bad in many of the ways you expect, but also in other ways you don't expect. And it goes, it pretty much goes where you expect, but the way it gets there is still surprising and still disappointing.
That's it.
And that was Wag the Dog, a pop-up podcast about Ben Platt, like me, apparently.
I'm Allison Smith. You can find me on Twitter at Queens Park Today.
I'm Jonathan Goldsby, and you can find me on Twitter at Goldsby, or apparently spending the next 20 years shooting a real-time version of Merrily We Roll Along with Richard Linklater. This episode was produced by Kevin Sexton, who we feel bad for dragging out to the Liberal leadership debate.
When Kevin arrived at the Liberal leadership debate a little earlier than us, a volunteer here, when he said he wanted to register, he meant as media, and they thought as a Liberal, and they got very excited to try to sign him up. Like a new nice boy Liberal for us? That would have made someone's day.
It would have. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. If you like what we do, please support us at patreon.com/CanadaLand.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.